I'm really happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass Danny Barnes. How you doing, Danny?
Hey, Steve, I'm doing pretty good, man.
Good.
Thanks a lot for talking to me today.
Hey, I'm privileged. I'm privileged to have you on. I will tell you this up front. Back in the early 90s, I found an album called The Delusions of Banjur, and I thought, well, that's the coolest name I've ever heard of, and it's by a band called The Bad Livers, and without even knowing anything about it, I bought it. And so I've been on your you've been on my radar screen for a long time, and I thought, and it is. I mean, I had no idea who you were. I didn't know what the band was, but I thought, okay, there's a banjo in there, like banjos, and I'm going to get this album, and there it was. I've actually played it on this program before. I've been playing bits of a song, yeah.
You know, the interesting thing about that record is that was produced by Paul Leary, legendary guitarist and producer from the Butthole Surfers.
Really?
Yeah, Paul Leary, yeah. His real name is Paul Walthall, but he goes by, his professional name is Paul Leary.
Right.
And yeah, he produced that record. Another interesting thing about that record is it was recorded to 2-inch tapes. It was recorded to tapes, so it's kind of a cool recording in that regard.
Yeah. That
Horses in the Mines also was recorded to tape, but that was recorded in my living room to this Atari half-inch machine. That was recorded to a 24-track Studer, if I'm not mistaken, 2-inch machine.
Been a busy year for you, Danny. I was happy. Robert Earl Keen was on this program back in May around when Happy Prisoner came out. And I'm talking to all the musicians about all the musicians on his thing, and you're on there, and I hadn't heard anything, hadn't seen you. I saw you years ago. You came to, I'm just south of Cincinnati. You came to some Ohio River Festival. I think you were playing with Tim O'Brien then.
That's right, the Tall Stack.
That's, you got it, yeah, man. So I saw that, and I thought, well, this is cool. Danny Barnes is playing with Robert Earl Keen on this new blue, and it's a great. I love Happy Prisoner. I think it's a great album. So I was talking about you then. You got this new thing coming out, which I got my hands on now. We're going to talk about, and then in the midst of all this, out of the blue, you win this Steve Martin Award for Banjo Excellence and Bluegrass Excellence. So you've had a busy year.
Yeah, it has been a busy year, man. I've done a bunch of shows and a lot of frequent flyer miles and put out a couple of records and just, man, I've been working. I'm thankful to be working. I work too much, but I enjoy it. So I guess it's good, you know. I don't really have a plan B. Plan B is pretty much the same as Plan A, I guess.
You have Plan Life. your plan is Plan Life, and that's the plan you got to stick to. I'm listening. I'm looking at Danny Barnes Got Myself Together 10 years later. I bought this as soon as it became available, so I got my copy a long time ago, and I've been listening to it a lot. And I have to say this. I met you. I'd never met you before, and you may not remember this, but it was at Raleigh at IBMA, and I'm walking around. I'm thinking, that guy's, you were sitting outside of the vendors area because you were waiting to go in and get a I think you were getting ahead for your band. I don't remember exactly the story.
Oh, that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
I had to get a part for this banjo. I had to get this exact banjo head, a low crown head, and which is a little bit tricky to find in because most people use a medium crown head. And I was like a little nervous about whether or not I could find the exact head that I needed.
Well, you weren't camping out in a tent like people do to get into those Black Friday, but you were right up against the door, man, staring at it, waiting for it to open. I said, I thought, that's Danny Barnes. I just went over and congratulated you because by then you'd gotten the award. And you said something to me then, and I mean, you said thanks for all this stuff. And you said, you know, I didn't think anybody was listening to me, or words to that effect. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, because I want to talk about the album because that's the main reason I got you on, but getting this award, because I know they're real secretive about it, just sort of like arrives and then they're gone like a will o' the wisp. But what, you had no clue this was going to happen, right?
Absolutely no clue whatsoever. Just, it came totally out of the blue. Like I had no concept whatsoever. It was like being struck by a meteor or something. No idea.
Well, when you get it, do they deliver the statue? They have this really cool statue. I say they, meaning the committee of all these incredible guys that Steve's put together. Do they deliver the statue and then you get the check with it at the same time?
No, the statue came later.
Okay.
They cast that, and there's a, like, they have a, the statue is amazing. It's worth looking up on the internet and getting a look at it. It's an amazing piece. I think he's like one of the foremost collectors of contemporary art
he
in
is
the country.
That. Yeah.
So he's smart enough to I'm spacing out on the feller's name, but he had a really killer guy make this piece, you know, this little piece, and it's just amazing.
It is.
I had seen him a few weeks before at a festival, and we talked for a little bit, and then I was practicing. I get up real early when I'm working on records, and, well, I get up early a lot, but I was up really early recording, and I think I started about 4 in the morning, and the FedEx came around 11 or something, so I'd already been at it, like, you know, 7 hours or whatever, and then this FedEx came from Steve Martin. It was like Upper West Side and everything in New York there, and so I thought he'd sent me a CD of his, but then I remembered that I didn't have his address.
Oh.
And so I tear it into the FedEx, and there's no CD in there. And I was kind of like, oh, man, there's no record in here. But then this little piece of paper sort of flutters to the ground, and it had, you know, had 50,000 written on it. Mm-hmm. As a check, you know, and that was unbelievable. So, and so anyway.
So who do you contact first when that happens?
Well, the first thing I did was look at it for like, you know, a couple, 3 minutes, and just sort of in complete shock about it, you know. So I sat and stared at it for a while, and I don't know, I guess I just started calling my friends and stuff, you know, and I talked to mostly just my friends and stuff, the people, my close buddies and stuff, told them, and my mom and my brother and the people I play music with and my friends and things, and probably called about 20 to 25 people about it, and it was pretty amazing. Like, To be honest, I figured that they had made some type of mistake and sent to me by mistake or something, because, I mean, man, I'm sort of an underground artist, so I didn't really expect anything like that, so it was a real shock.
Well, you know, it's a real tribute to the people that that Steve's put together on that committee, that they're able to look around and find, and I know a lot of people on that committee, and I know they always thought highly of you. So, I mean, it's kind of cool that this committee can find people like, I say, people like Danny Barnes. I mean, you do consider yourself sort of under the radar for a lot of this stuff, because I've read where you talked that the banjo people have always been really nice people. Man, you're a banjo people, you know, so you can't keep separating yourself even verbally from those kind of, because you're one of them.
But, yeah, I suppose that's correct. It's just hard. The list of just like the people that are on that board, like, you know, for instance, just J.D. Crowe himself. I mean, like, man, I've been trying to figure out his banjo playing since 1973 or 74 when I became aware of his stuff. So I've been trying to, I mean, yeah, that's a long time. I've been at it for 44 years of practicing and working. Really practicing. I mean, I take lessons and work and just constantly trying to develop ideas and things. I mean, I work hard at it. Like, the day that award came, I was at it at 4 in the morning. I put in a lot of time on practicing and writing and trying to make things and come up with ideas and rehearse things and study and edit and research and all that. It takes... That's one thing, that's probably... Just as an aside, that's one thing that I never would have been able to correctly calculate when I started doing this stuff, just like how much time it takes, you know, like it just takes so much work, you know, like for instance, an example, just if you look at Steve Martin's, like his shows, like when he was doing those he was playing these huge stadiums and arenas and stuff just by himself, you know, but his show was just meticulously worked out, you know. There's so much work, you know, in on every, you know, every comment and phrase and little aside and facial expression and everything.
You mean on his stand-up stuff?
Yeah. Just his stand-up stuff that, you know, just probably everything he's ever done, really. But
you know, I get the feeling that nothing is an accident to him, that he's very precise.
He's a pretty astute fella, and he works at it really hard, and that's inspiring to me, too. I mean, I'm on a much smaller level. I'm on a tiny, tiny level compared to a fellow of that caliber. Really, compared to everyone on that list. I mean, everybody on that list, Noam and Bela and Allison and, you know, everybody on there and Pete and, you know, shucks, I'm not in that league, so to speak, but I work at it really hard and I practice really hard. I spend a lot of time on the road, you know, and I work at it really hard. I spend a lot of time trying to develop new ideas for the banjo. Like, I kind of, roughly speaking, sort of consider myself to be like sort of a one-man R&B department in the banjo world, you know? Like, I'm always trying to come up with new context for the banjo and different things like that.
Well, and Danny, I want to talk about the Barnyard Electronics stuff also, but you made a good point, and this can be a nice jumping-off point. You know, you've been working on it, and everybody that's ever picked up a banjo, when you hear JD's tone and what he does and the timing, you want to do that. And yet, even though as much as you study and practice, you don't sound like anybody else as far as your approach to playing.
You know, a lot of that comes from being from Texas, because, like, the other day I was traveling with Rob and Ronnie, you know,
mm-hmm.
McCorys.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, like, when you talk to Robbie, if you ask him, did you ever get to meet Don Reno? And he's like, yeah, Don Reno was over at the house. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he tells you how old he was. And Don, you know, he got to see all that stuff firsthand. And being from where I'm from, it was a lot harder because you're not in the hotbed of all that, you know. And you have to kind of look. It reminds me of how the British guys must have looked at blues in that, you know, say, like, the Stones and the Beatles and those bands and the Kinks and whatnot, because it was from this other place, you know. And so you're learning the music from these records, and it's really difficult to get the information. You got to really work at it, you know. Like, it must have been really different for, you know, a lot of the second-generation banjo guys. Like, even growing up in New York, I mean, you're right there, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and being from Texas, it's like everything is kind of you're once removed from a lot of that stuff, you know. Though by the time I started getting into that stuff in the 70s, those bands were coming through there, and I saw Ralph a bunch, and I saw Sonny Osborne quite a bit, you know, and I got to see those guys. I saw John Hartford a lot, and I saw a lot of the guys would come through, and I tried to see everyone that I could, you know. But coming from Texas is like you – from a literary perspective, from an art perspective, and from a music perspective, like, people from Texas, it's like kind of a melting pot, you know? And so you have, like, sort of like a lot of Mexican influence. You got a lot of influence from the southern American states or whatever. You have that sort of southern influence. There's a blues influence.
Sure, and there's New Orleans stuff.
There's a lot
going
on there. A lot of great guitar players that play a lot of different kinds of styles. T-Bone Walker and, you know, so many things. Willie Johnson, and I mean, Willie Johnson came from Marlin, Texas, which was just like 20 miles away from where I was born, you know. Like, so a lot of those guys, you know, there's a rich history of music, but not bluegrass, so to speak. So it's interesting that you kind of develop a little bit different take on a lot of that stuff, which I suppose it ends up being an asset because you have a unique look at it or whatever, but at the same time it's kind of tough because, like, you're always aware that you're not in the club, you know. Like, you know, it must have been really something to just be able to, you know, see Bill Emerson and, you know, grew up in D.C. One of my buddies grew up in D.C. and he's just telling me about seeing everybody playing.
Yeah.
One of my buddies was telling me about going to see Don Stover, who's probably my main banjo hero, is Don Stover.
Yeah.
And talking about living in D.C. and he could. It, I think he said it took him like 10 hours or whatever, 12 hours, however long it took him to drive to Boston, you know, and he could see Don Stover playing it and would go up there a lot, you know, and it's, man, that must have just been really great. Whereas I had to kind of work everything out off of records, you know.
But
what was neat about that was the way I did it was I put it on reel-to-reel machines and slowed them down. So that got me interested in recording machines and got me interested in recording as a thing, too, because I had to mess with machines in order to figure out those songs. So my training, I went to school for audio at University of Texas. Like, my training is in audio, and that kind of ended up being an asset in itself, you know, because I've been messing with tape decks and sound and recording and mics and effects and things like that ever since I was a kid. And I think that was one of the things that kind of led me through that path was I had to use machines to figure out that music. There weren't teachers. And I mean, nowadays, if a person wants to learn how to play the banjo, there's more information than you could possibly sort through in a complete lifetime.
Yeah, there is.
Back then, all you had was the Pete Seeger book, that red Pete Seeger book.
Yeah, right.
Sonny Osborne had a book that was almost impenetrable, like the tablature in it, the system in it was really strange, but it had good information in
right.
it. And then, the Earl's book,
yeah.
which had some errors in it, and which was a little bit funnily put together.
Yes, it was.
Awesome book, but that was all you had, mm-hmm. you know. And then records, you know. And it was tough, you know. I had to really. So anyway, you end up doing a lot of things really differently. Like I read somewhere, like there's a Sufi guy. I forget which one of the guys said it, but there's a Sufi guy that said, "Without a guide, a two-day journey can take you 20 days or something, or 20 years or something. Like, without a guide, a two-day journey can take 20 years. That's the line.
Well,
without a guide, a two-day journey can take 20 years.
Well, yeah, but you're going to learn a whole lot more, I think, in 20 days.
Yeah.
Maybe not. You know what I'm saying?
And you don't have a choice.
No, you don't.
It's what you got.
Well, that's,
you got to, you know, you have to work with what you have.
That's funny that you mentioned this recording experience that you had because, and I'm holding in my hands, I'm looking at the new Danny Barnes, Got Myself Together, 10 years later, let me ask you this, because I did have a note about this. On Corn Kingdom Come, about 20 seconds left into the song, it goes backwards, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought, wait a minute, am I listening to Sgt. Pepper's again? I put that back. I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? This is supposed to be.
I really like the sound of the banjo backwards,
okay.
like in my Barnyard Electronics setup, when I use a computer to manipulate the banjo. I really love playing the banjo backwards. It's really interesting because you have this long tail and this quick clip over the note would begin going forwards. And it's really fun to play things backwards on the banjo because, and by that I don't mean physically, I mean for your listeners, I mean actually grab the audio and then flip the audio
right,
backwards.
Right, right.
I do it in computer. I wrote a little program that allows you to do that. And it's easy to do in a contemporary digital audio workstation or whatever, but I figured out I wrote a little piece of software to use on a computer when I play live.
Oh, okay.
And anyway, I'm in love with that sound.
Well, it's like 20 seconds to go and everything goes backwards, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, I need to. So I'm glad you brought up your recording history and background.
And it happens again on the bonus track. I believe it's on the bonus track also. I'm Convicted.
I think you're right.
By the way, have you seen the video for that?
I have. Yes, I saw it. It came in my email, and I posted it right away everywhere I could because I just thought it was great. I think it's a neat. It's funny on the album what Danny's talking about. On the album, it just says Encore, but when you actually play it, it's called I'm Convicted, and it's real accessible to everybody right now because you put out a video of I'm Convicted, which is kind of a It's an interesting video. I mean,
it's a Barnyard Electronics audio approach, and then we sort of took a Barnyard Electronics approach with the video part as well. That's an old Bad Liver song. It was on a record called Industry and Thrift.
Oh, I don't have that one. Okay.
It's actually a song I wrote for the Bad Livers probably in 97 or something, 98, right in there.
Well, that's where everybody can see that now, and I got that because I guess when I a long time ago I signed on to your email list, and people can do that, and you sent that out, and you also sent out, let me ask you this, and we're going to get to the album, I promise, but on the same thing where you had the video of I'm Convicted, you said, here's a song to download for your holiday shows. It's called Cows. And I kept thinking, I mean, I do a holiday show, but I thought, well, I'm not exactly sure where that 6 minutes of really interesting stuff is going to fit in December.
Well, I don't know. I just thought maybe it would maybe work. I don't know. I've never made a holiday movie.
I know. I'm just.
I thought maybe it would work. Maybe that may have been a close play at second base.
Oh, that's good enough. But I mean, I liked it. But I just thought, well, if Danny says this is for your holiday show, where am I going to fit this in? And I've opted not to put it in, but I'll play it sometime. I just thought, well, it's not going to fit for this Saturday.
That's off a record I did called Ambient Works Volume 1. It's like an ambient record that I did that I made here at home and really enjoyed making. And and it's from a record called Ambient Works.
Yeah. Well, it has that feel of something that you would. Ambient is a great description of what it is, and I mean it's a neat. On the album that we're talking about, if you just tuned in, we're talking to Danny Barnes, which I'm having a thrill doing this from. Got Myself 10 years later together. 10 years later, you used no finger picks.
On the record, on Got Myself Together, I played with bare fingers on an open back banjo. There's only there's one or two overdubs where I use picks and a resonator banjo. But almost all the banjo, all the way through the tune, is an open back banjo I got from my buddy Rob Bischline down in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
It's an open back banjo with like a Dobson style tone ring. It's like an old style tone ring. And I play with my bare fingers. And the reason why I did that was, you know, there's like this secret music that's the music that musicians play when no one's listening.
Okay.
And if you, you know, like when you hang out with somebody, like I learned it from hanging out with guys like Bill Frisell and Chuck Lavelle and just all these great musicians that I'm fortunate enough to get to run around with from time to time, Tim O'Brien and all these various guys. They have, you know, you have this music that you play for each other, you know. And a lot of times with banjo players, they'll play with their fingers. And it's a really warm, kind of friendly sound. Like say, you know, if you're over at a banjo player's house and they pull out a banjo and they hand it to you, a lot of times you just play it with your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really different sound, you know. Like, then they go on stage with the banjo and they put their picks on and play with the picks, which is a sharper sound.
Right.
But it's kind of like a secret banjo sound that you just don't hear,
okay,
unless you're a banjo player. You hear it all the time because you play with your fingers a lot. Like you wake up in the morning and make some coffee and play the banjo for a while, and you sit there and play with just your fingers because it's just a nice, accessible, kind of easy sound that's fun to listen to, and you don't have to like mess with picks or whatever. It's really convenient. But you don't really hear very many records in the banjo realm or in bluegrass where people play the banjo that way. And I just thought it would be an interesting way of interesting palette choice for the entire record. I think there's one or two overdubs with picks, but basically it's all bare fingers on an open back banjo.
Well, there's so many different, the reason I bring that up is this. Yes, you're playing an open back and you're playing bare fingers, but you do everything. You do what people would call clawhammer three finger. Your right hand, from what I've seen, you might be on the other side of the bridge sometimes. You might be up close to, I mean, you seem to cover everything where you need to get that right sound that you want, what you want to do with that. And maybe this is good then, Danny, that you didn't live in the fertile crescent of three finger, you know, Scruggs, because you're looking for other ways to find the sound that you want to get out.
Yeah, that's what that could be the case. It's it's like John was the same way. Like John, I remember talking to John Hartford about it, and he said one time he was talking and he got this. He was talking to me about learning, and he just got this kind of sad look on his face, and he says, "You know, I could never play a single note of music that sounded like Earl Scruggs, and that's all I wanted to do, and I could never do it." And here's a guy who has had more success than most of us will ever have in a lot of different fields.
Right.
But yet, he said it to me in this way where it was, you know, I really got to see kind of inside his brain there for a second. He was like, "Man, I never could even play one note of music that sounded like Earl. And that was all I wanted to do, you know." But yet he developed this, like, there's nobody that can play the banjo like John.
No, totally different.
Like, you can't even play a single bar of music that sounds like John Hartford.
No.
No one has ever been able to do that. And, like, I got little things I can kind of pick, I can sort of do a few things that he did, but basically I can't mimic that at all. I can mimic a lot of the guys, but I can't even begin to play like that, you know. So I guess that's kind of, like you're saying, that's, you know, that's kind of what happens. That's part of, like, the striving for art. You tend to actually kind of make stuff by accident, you know, and all that stuff.
Well,
and my banjo teacher, Pat Cloud, has said that to me before. Like, sometimes you're... your sort of like your hindrances or your incapacities, I think you said, end up being your strengths somehow, you know.
Well, and then,
if you pencil it out over a long enough time, you know what I mean? If you can stay in the game and pencil it out over 20, 30 years instead of 2 years or something, you know.
And for the listeners, although I think I have a pretty hip audience, but Pat Cloud is this like legendary jazz banjo player out on the West Coast, right?
Yeah, he lives in Long Beach down there in California.
Yeah, yeah, he doesn't have a lot of weaknesses. I mean, he can teach you stuff, but I mean, Pat Cloud's playing is a whole. He's playing jazz. He's not, you know, he's not trying to interpret jazz tunes through. He's playing jazz on a banjo. And
yeah, he's not playing
stuff.
Turkey in the Straw. No, 2-5-1 progression. He's a great band. He's really done a lot of study in the banjo pedagogy that I think will take the banjo world a lot of years to catch up.
That's correct. Listen, on the new album, which I chuckle for some. You have a sense of humor about many things. They're not trying to be humorous, but I feel the humor in some of your stuff that you're playing. I don't mean like funny ha, but it's like it makes me chuckle because I've tried. I play a little bit, and I know you're doing some things that are just are very unique and very special and kind of make me smile. I'll tell you the song that when you mentioned John Hartford. The vocal part, not the playing, but the vocal part on Getting On Down the Line, I think is real close to some of the things that I would hear John try to sing. Now, here's my question about that. The playing that you're doing with that song is just, I mean, if there was a way to say, here's what you can expect from Danny Barnes, he's got this vocal, which is pretty cool. It does a little bit of you even do one note that might sound like John Hartford, but what you're playing behind on the banjo is something I can't even imagine what you're doing, and it works. But those are so different things to me when I hear that song. It's one of my favorite tunes on it for that reason. I mean,
the thing about that kind of playing is like the funny thing happened to me when I was a kid, and that is. They used to have these magazines called Look and Life magazine. You remember those magazines?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Remember that?
Yeah, man.
I'll be 54 on Monday. And anyway, like, I remember they had, like, an issue of one of those magazines back in the late 60s, early 70s. I think it had Ornette on it.
Okay.
And I was really interested in music. I got really interested in music from, you know, really early age. My family just played records all the time, though they weren't musicians really. But
and again, for the listeners, we're talking about Ornette Coleman.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was asking my older brothers, what is jazz? What is jazz? What is that? Because I knew what blues was sort of, and I knew what country was, and I kind of knew these idioms. But that was like, what does that mean? And like I see the Modern Jazz Quartet on TV, and they were awesome, you know. But one of my brothers had an Ornette record. It wasn't the double quartet record, but it was a later record of Ornette. And I thought that what like Albert Eiler and Ornette were doing and all that was jazz. I didn't know about Standards and Charlie Parker and How High the Moon and all that history. I just didn't know anything about that because when I became aware of it. That's when more like the downtown stuff out of New York was happening those guys.
Yeah,
I didn't know anything about all the stuff that was before that. So I've always sort of had this thing, interest in like that kind of music, like that period of jazz. Even though like in that one of those documentaries that came out in the last few years that was on PBS, like they kind of skip over that period as being like. You know, and then all these guys came and brought it all back towards, you know, and they sort of skipped over, which is my favorite period, you know, that, like Albert Eiler and that period is, to me, really interesting as far as, like, just a fan, you know, and compositionally speaking and harmonically, rhythmically, motifically, in all these different ways that music is, like, unparalleled.
And I think too that Ornette kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, when you listen to it now, you think you understand it more. I do, but at the time he was doing that, it's like this didn't fit the progression of even where Miles was going. It's all of a sudden
and
he was
the
out
same
on the
time, he was from a Fort Worth R&B band.
Yeah, that's all that's right.
So there was still some of that in there too. You're right. Still kind of like a dance band in a weird way, like in a really odd way. I don't know. It was really complex, but anyway, I'm not saying that that banjo part is lack or net, but there's like a free way of playing where there's like a free language in between everything. Because like if you watch a bluegrass band play harmonically and rhythmically, there's like a grid that gets made. The bass is going bing bong bing bong bing bong, and the guitar's going boom ching ding ching ding ching ding ding. The band's going ding a ding a ding a ding a ding a ding. The fiddle's going ding a ding ding. He's playing like these long things, and the vocals kind of going, well, a long time ago, when we left my house. So you get these kind of this grid of like ding dong, ding ching ding ching ding ching ding 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 ding. Like it's like a little grid thing.
Those are your guardrails on either side of the road.
Yeah, or a little dots going down the line. That's right, yeah, or those pickets on the fence. But then there's all this stuff in between there, you know, that like that is suggested by that. That like I never really caught on to that stuff until I started running around with Bill. And like Bill is kind of like he's always looking for that stuff, like in between everything. There's like these chords, and there's all this music in between what you're hearing. And it's really funny, like, because a lot of times you'll sit in with a band that's already got a banjo player. So there's, like, you know, a lot of things are in line. It's kind of a grid thing. And it's really fun to just start looking in between all that stuff. It's like going to a play, but you're looking behind the set, you know, looking under the chair or whatever.
Yeah, like
you're, like,
that.
Looking for what's not really there. But there's other stuff kind of hidden in sort of like the... in the structure, there's things hidden in there, and it's really fun to play in there, and that kind of playing is what I'm alluding to in that regard is that there's stuff hidden in there. Like there's one of my teachers one time said, there's consonants and dissonance, there's dissonance and consonants. So you know, in a way, there's a lot of consonants in Albert Ayler's playing, and there's a lot of dissonance in Bach, depending on how you're listening to it or whatever, and it's just really fun as a player to start finding that stuff, those little cracks. And harmonically, you can play up in the chords, you know, where you have like a G chord, then there's like a G dominant 7 chord, then there's like a G 9 chord, and then there's like an 11 and a 13. There's like these harmonies that are up in the chords. That it's like a kind of a secret language up there. And it's just
I like the description.
You kind of poke around in there.
And the thing, too, and we'll get off of Bill Prezel, maybe, maybe not, but because I enjoy this, but the thing about his playing is when you think this is a really great inventive guitarist, kind of out of the jazz school, but I don't really know what he does a lot of the time. He's just kind of doing his thing. But you're not going to put the record on and say, man, there's a flurry of notes, and it's incredible. He's doing the stuff. He's doing the big he's doing, like, well, you described it so well. He's finding other things in there, but he's not going to be this blistering, you know, solo that he's not going to be George, I mean, you know, I'll say for speed, George Benson or John McLaughlin or one of those. He's just doing this thing, and he's just kind of cruising around. That's the way I describe it. And every time I get one of his records, I told you this maybe off the air, it's like, well, okay, now what's he doing? Now where's he going? It's Bill Frisell, but he has different sounds and different things that he does. So I think you're probably the banjo version of Bill Frisell. I'm going to say that.
I appreciate you saying that. I like that. That's a heck of a compliment. I feel like, you know, like I've learned from like meditation and from martial arts that you kind of have to find a master, you know. And part of the job as someone that's interested in something is to recognize a true master. And Bill is a true master of music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not very many masters on the earth at any one time. You only have a few at any time. If you could go back to the caveman days, and there's only a few at a time. You only get a handful of them at any one time. And Bill is a true master. And there again, I've worked with him a fair amount where there's a lot of stuff that we do, him and I do, in my living room and in dressing rooms and things. Like, it's like this other music that we play that's not been recorded or anything. It's just for us. But it's like being able to watch him tune up and watch him arrange things and watch him record and watch him do a film score and watch him play with an orchestra and, you know, work with him in all these different environments, you know, and you realize this is a true master of music because his thing is so elevated, you know. It's like from a whole nother place because there's people who are like, you know, professional musicians who, but then there's like guys who are trying to be masters is like the next level up. And then you got the real masters, and there's not very many of them. Mm-hmm. And Bill is definitely one of the masters, a true master. And like I say, it's very important for people that if you're interested in music, you have to eventually ask yourself this question, who is the master? You have to ask that question.
Yeah.
You know, you have to ask that question.
And you have to ask it, and you have to convince yourself you found one.
You know when you found
well,
one.
I mean,
you know
it's good when you found.
There's no. It's self-evident.
Okay.
You don't have to convince. It's self-evident. It answers its own question.
Okay. What we.
But a true master is a real gift, and oh man, I'm just a. I'm a total. Obviously, I'm a fan, but like, man, he is like amazing, you know, and just I've learned so much about through Bill, with Bill, I've learned so much about music, about how music works. And because here's an example, I'll make this short.
No, that's okay, take your time.
We're working on a tour, we're getting ready to do a tour of European jazz festivals, and we're working on shows with like Carla Bley and Dave Holland and Joe Lovano, and It's going to be a cool trip, you know.
This is in the future you're talking about.
No, we've done that.
Oh, you've done that. Okay.
We're getting ready to leave.
Okay.
And so we're working on, he brings over a stack of music maybe knee-high. And we're just reading through all these charts, you know, all this music, you know, and we're going through there. And I work through maybe 25 pages of this music. And I realize, like, in like, Western music or, say, in like country music or like blues music or like bluegrass or whatever, there's like these certain little things that get done a lot. Like, for instance, in a lot of bluegrass tunes, there's like this little whoop-diddy-doo at the end that brings it back to the beginning.
Yeah, little turnaround.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's like these little, you know, there's like chords appear in certain places according to their function, they appear in certain places and things like that. There's like a language of how chords and melodies happen. And there's like stuff that, like, for instance, a lot of fiddle tunes are like little conversations. Like Cripple Creek is a perfect example. Like Cripple Creek is like, it's like a question.
And the answer. Okay. I like that. Okay. I follow.
And then it asks another question. And there's another answer. And there's like a little conversation about that. And the other person goes. It's like there's these little structures to the language of it. But when you look at his music, all that stuff is moved over. And like where you think something's going to happen, nothing happens. And then where you would expect nothing to happen, there's like this big boulder there. And it just really, it's like kind of melted, you know. And it's just amazing because he can play something really, really simple that is just diatonic, basically. And it's just whole notes,
mm-hmm.
half notes, maybe a quarter note, triad chords, but something is, it's like those Béla Bartók Microcosmos books, those piano method books. It's like you look at it and it looks normal, but when you play it, there's just something kind of melty about it. You know, it's like a little bit different. And that kind of stuff, to me, is like finding buried treasure or something, finding something in your yard that you didn't know was buried there, or finding a $20 bill in the parking lot or something. It's just like these gifts that just keep occurring and stuff.
Do you think...
I try to put that in my music.
Well, okay. No, that's good. I this is great. So on Get It On Down the Line, we kind of got into this area about what you're playing. I want to take, just since we've talked about that, we're going to end, well, by the time we end, we're going to play Big Shoe, which I just think is gorgeous, but that is the Bill Frisell, correct?
Yeah.
But let's take a minute now and play for people who've been listening and they've heard you talk about Get On Down the Line and all the magic stuff. We're going to play that tune and then we'll be right back. We're talking to Danny Barnes and we're going to play you a cut from the brand new Got Myself Together 10 Years Later. This will be from that album. Get On Down the Line, you just heard him talk about. So let's play that. All right, Danny, we just listened to this, the tune that we had a nice discussion about, and all the different things that happens when songs and doesn't happen in songs, and all the places you can go, and it was a neat discussion. That are you singing as you're playing?
Yeah.
There's no way. There's no way you can do that. No.
Yeah, it's just, man, I've been practicing on that so
there's
long.
No way.
I can do it. You know, I've been at it a long time, and I practice it, like practice doing that, because like it's good practice to try to play from a place that's not really like thinking about structure so much. You know, I guess is that rap brain, or I forget how the hemispheres work, but like it's more kind of like ethereal sort of approach or whatever on that. And that line, you can work in a coal mine, you can make a little moonshine, you can get it on down the line. I think that comes from like Walker Percy or Flannery O'Connor, somebody, some of those southern kind of gothic writers. I'm not sure where there was a novel I saw that in, and like it's like a, you know, they're back in the hills somewhere, and that's like the three things you can do to make a living, you know, is either get the heck out of there, you can do something illegal, or you go down in the mines, you know. That was like the three choices that the men had, you know.
Yeah.
And it's funny how things like that are sort of allegorical for like a lot of different environments and a lot of different people and a lot of different things. You know, you kind of like you got like this job that you're probably going to hate that's really dangerous that's going to kill you, or you can do something illegal that's probably going to kill you, or you're going to wind up in jail, or you just knock the table over and go somewhere else. It's kind of an interesting take on things, but the poetry of that is designed to sort of, like, it's kind of like when you read the Bible, it has things in there where like it applies to everything. It's like a desert people or whatever, but at the same time, you know, it sort of could apply to a traffic jam in L.A. or something, you know. So those kind of things have always interested me in terms of like, you know, literature and things like that. The way they have, like, you could be reading Moby Dick, but in a way, it's about working in an office, you know.
Well, okay, I can go with you on that, but I'm telling you, everybody's now just heard Get It On Down the Line, and how you're singing that melody line that you sing, which I say is almost, it could almost be John Hart, it could be a John Hart, but what you're playing beneath it is, and how you can do them both at the same time, that's a question I had written down to ask you. Were you singing over your playing or playing? But if you're doing them both at the same time, you have some sort of trauma between your hemispheres and your brain that allows them to talk at a level the rest of us can't.
That's a funny trick. I can sing that stuff, too. I can also, the stuff that I'm playing on the banjo, I can scat sing it as I play it, too,
oh,
which
geez.
Is an interesting skill. I had a teacher. In other words, I can just sing the stuff. It's not gibberish. It's cool. Like, it's music. It's stuff I'm trying to play.
Yeah,
you know,
sure. No, yeah, you're not playing garbage.
But I had a teacher, because it's possible on a banjo or like a fiddle or whatever to rip and just play really fast scales that don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a teacher stop me one day and say, from now on, you can't play anything that you can't sing. Because, you know, after about 4 or 5 years of practicing an instrument, you can blaze really fast, but you're just really playing scales and you're not really playing melodies. They're just scales. And
yeah.
A lot of people that you see like that play really, really fast that don't have a lot of experience, that's kind of what they're doing. They're just, it's like a trick or something.
They're patching scales together.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You can run them really fast and do these little. You can do these little patterns, but you're not really doing anything.
Yeah.
You're not. There's not an idea. It's just like a trick kind of. And so it's like juggling or something. It's like a trick. But anyway. So this teacher told me that you have to be able to sing what you're playing or you can't play it. And so I wasn't able to play it all for a couple of weeks, but then I got right there and go, you know, and play it at the same time. And that really helped my playing. You know, it really helped me a lot because it allowed, because like with the banjo, it's possible to play in a very vocal way, you know, and that really ties in the expression of the banjo into a voice. And that was a real big moment for me. And like one time John told me that, like, he says, play, there's a record called American Made World Plate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of Earl's later records.
Mm-hmm.
And he plays Folsom Prison Blues on there. And John said, if you play it, you can tell what verse he's on. Like, he's doing an instrumental version of it, and you can hear the words and what he's playing, you know. Like, you can tell what verse he's on.
Well, I've always, and I've been told by smarter people than me, and I've read that he was always trying to play the words.
Yeah, that's kind of something I've learned. When you first start playing, you're just trying to get the notes. You know?
Yeah.
You don't think about concepts like that. But that's what I had learned later. That's what John was telling me. And I heard there's somebody else. I heard an anecdote, one of those like jazz anecdotes where somebody's playing and they stopped and. Their answer was they forgot the words or something. There was like a sax player, a horn player, and he was, you know, playing a ballad or something, and he stops. And I forgot the words. He couldn't remember what the playing the words.
Ben Webster would not play a ballad unless he knew the words. So I mean
that right? Maybe it was a Ben Webster story.
It could have happened to him.
You know what that does is that really gives a lot of musicality to your playing.
Mm-hmm.
It really brings your playing up. I think. I think that concept, because it's like with a banjo, man, you can play so fast, you know, but it's just like a typewriter. It doesn't really necessarily, you're not really, may not be saying anything necessarily. And so it just really, it's an interesting thing. John was the one that sort of got me going on that a long time ago. But, and as a matter of fact, have you ever seen that videotape of his called The Banjo According to John Hartford, I think?
I don't think so.
He talks a lot about that stuff in there. There's two, I think Happy Trom may have done it, or I forget who did that. Did those? It's a two VHS. I'm sure they redone it on DVD.
They're probably, if they're that old, they're probably homespun, which would be Happy Trom.
Yeah. Anyway, he kind of talks about a lot of those concepts in there, and those DVDs are amazing to watch for any instrument, because there's a lot of understanding about how music works as a language, you know. Because, like, the tricky thing is you can learn how to play an instrument sort of in a mechanical way, and you can get gigs, and you can make records or CDs or whatever, make MP3s. You can do all this stuff and book gigs and do all this stuff, but you kind of got to ask yourself, what in the heck am I saying, you know? Like, and that's what made those old guys like Earl and Don Stover and John and Bill Monroe and Bill Keith. And what was important to me about what those guys were doing is you could hear their life in the music. Like Del McCoy, perfect example. You can really hear his personality and his life in the music itself.
Yeah, you're right.
You know?
You're right.
And that makes the music much more alive and vibrant, I think, you know.
There are so many great, Danny, there are so many great songs on this album. And each one is its own little story. We were talking off the air about, and I'm not going to we talk about Wasted Mind a little bit because it happened to be the one that I had just shut off as I called you. But Wasted Mind to me is, I think I may have, you said you had a story about it or something about that song.
Yeah, I'm a 12-step person. I just saw this kid in a meeting. Like, that story is I got on a city bus and I travel by myself a lot. And I got on this bus, and it was like I was sitting near the back, and I got my banjo, and it's like me and this kid. And this kid was probably about 18 or 19 years old. And he had, like, you know, the flat-brimmed ball cap with the sticker on it kind of pulled down over his ears, you know, and, like, the basketball shorts. And he just kind of had that, whatever that look is, you know, that those kids have, you know. And he was talking to me, and he was like, oh, you're a musician. Well, I'm a rapper, he starts telling me. You know, he's a rapper, you know. And he starts rapping to me in the back of his bus. He's like this kid, you know. And so I started talking to him, you know, on the ride. And he's like, you know, couldn't find out. He's like got two kids, and he's already been to jail a few times. And, you know, he's trying to get it together. But, you know, he's kind of like also like, you know, had dope on him there, you know, in the bus and everything. But anyway, just kind of a, but it's such an archetype, you know. It's just like this Steinbeckian archetype of American life or whatever, you know. And so that whole poem is really just kind of about this kid, you know. And, it's kind of sad in a way. It's funny in a way.
Yeah, right.
It's true. It's just like, it's sort of like a lot of our life, you know. It's like a lot of, like, people's lives are wrapped up in this stuff, you know, like lottery tickets and cigarettes and NASCAR and, you know, all these weird things.
What's the line?
Like, you know, this weird existence, you know, video games and whatever all that stuff is. You know, I'm not, it's, you know, it's a couple generations younger than me, so I'm not really sure of the context, but man, they're, you know, they have a, it's an interesting life, and it's, it, anyway, so I felt like with this kid, I got a real sort of picture of his trip, you know, and so that whole song is about, you know, you got headers on your Honda. You should have spent the money on a carburetor overhaul.
That's
like,
right.
I got behind one of these kids one time, and he put them that 4-inch header on his Honda, on them, one of those little cars,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't change the, you got to change the carburetor around to get it to run, because now the back pressure is different, you know, so you got to adjust the carburetor, because you got, or the fuel injection, because you got this, you change the exhaust ratio, right? You change the back pressure. So if you just bolt one of them 4-inch exhausts on a car, it won't even hardly run, you know. You kind of got, there's more you got to do to it to get it to work.
Danny, do you remember the line in that song? And I don't, even though I just listened to it before I called you, about hoping that his car doesn't stall on the way to court or something.
Yeah, exactly. So that rusty bookie won't stall at the courthouse.
Right.
Yeah, man.
And you know, it's, you don't want to laugh at the individual, because there are people like that, and circumstances occur. But it's funny how you put it all together and made that story. It's
like a little play, you know.
Yeah,
it's like a little play. But hey, man, he's doing good, man. I ran through today, actually. He's doing good.
Good.
I don't know, he's doing pretty good. He's all right, you know. He's out of jail and he's doing all right.
Good.
So, I mean, shucks.
Chuck.
Well, who am I to judge?
Well, I agree with you, but it's all the songs are different. They're all, you have a unique touch in all this stuff. What I'm going to kick the show off, and you won't hear this now, but when I start the show off, I usually play a tune of an artist or guest I'm going to have on. I'm going to play, as we start off the show, when this runs, they will have already heard, the audience will already have heard Big Girl Blues. I just think that's a pretty banjo tune. That the playing on that is just, I have to say, it's just a kind of a pretty melody, and it's just nice to listen to.
Thank you. That one is like, the banjo has a broader palette than it's given credit for. So that's me exploring that part of the timbre of a banjo, mm-hmm. that is, it's not really given credit for being able to be played that way. Though John played that way a lot,
mm-hmm.
you know. He was able to play the banjo in that way. The chords are kind of like Beatles chords, or where they have kind of like this moving line on the bottom. Like I saw Mr. Bojangles, it's kind of like that, where there's like a moving line over these chords. They used to call them slash chords. I don't know if you've ever seen that, where you play like, you know, G with G in the bass, G over F sharp in the bass, like G with an E in the bass or whatever. Like have these, like these moving chord lines or whatever.
I've heard of the concept.
A lot of acoustic type songs that were on the radio in the 70s.
Yeah.
That movement, you know. And it's pretty, and it works out really nice on the banjo. It's in the key of E, which you don't normally, you know, like play without a capo. I just played in first position. You don't normally hear the banjo played in that key, but I really like playing the banjo in that key. And the poetry of that song, I guess it's kind of about, like, sort of like about a girl that got away or whatever. Like a fella is like you don't write these songs about yourself, because you run out of life after about 3 albums and you got to start making all this stuff up. It's just like the story of that song is like a guy's like just sort of thinking about the one that kind of got away, you know.
Yeah.
And he's kind of like wondering if she's okay, you know.
It's pretty. I like the melody. I like what you're playing on. I like the song. So they will hear that before they get to hear us talk. You write good songs, Danny. I know you spend a lot of time on writing. We've talked about how much you practice, but I know you put a lot of effort on in the writing these tunes that we're talking about just on this album. But you do write a lot, and you put a lot of effort and a lot of your soul into that.
I feel like you have to have a love of poetry itself, because I look at them like poems. And so many times you hear people want you to listen to a song, or you hear someone sing, and you go, this person has never read a book of poetry, you know. So I feel like I was lucky enough to get interested in poetry as a young man, but, like, there's a way the syllables work like notes. And the sound of a syllable works like a D-flat or like a pitch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They have
okay.
a way they work. And so it's nice to, like, I'm from school, I remember, like, concepts like alliteration and onomatopoeia and, you know, iambic pentameter and different types of structure and all these little things you learn in, like, whatever, sophomore English or junior English or whatever, you know. But I got an appreciation for poetry in my high school. And, well, really younger than that. I had poetry books even as a young man. But anyway, I think, to me, if you really want to get your lyrics together, you should study poetry and find somebody you really like and really dive into it. Because, you know, a lot of times you hear, and there's songs that are huge songs on the radio, but they sort of, they'll have like, in Nashville they call it a rub, where it like rubs funny, like there's a word in there that was kind of funny, like that wasn't really the right word or something like that, mm-hmm. It'll rub funny. And it's important to make the, you want to make the lyrics or the poem where it's conversational, but it still rhymes, but it sounds like someone talking, and the rhymes aren't forced, you know.
It needs
and
all.
It takes a lot of work to do that.
It needs all fit together.
Studying poetry is really helpful.
Well, I mean, I think this is. I think your songs. I'm not talking about your playing, but I think your songs show that devotion to the words and the sounds and having everything fit and avoiding those rubs and whatnot. So I really enjoy this album. I've had it since it came out because I got it right away. I got my copy. I've been listening every day. I have a different favorite. We've talked about Bill Frisell a lot, and I'm going to end. When we're finished here, I'm going to play Big Shoe, and I'm going to ask you why you picked that one out to play on this new album.
Well, I played that a lot with Bill, and I just love that song because it's sort of like a bluegrass song, but it's kind of melted. Like it has places where, like the last four bars, Bill just holds a G for four bars in the tune. And normally, like if you take a tune like Devil's Dream or something, like the last part of the tune is like it's winding you up to get you going again. And that tune, you just kind of sit there and simmer, you know, for like four bars. So it's kind of like a bluegrass tune, or sort of like a blues/bluegrass thing. Kind of, it reminds me a little bit in a way like those tunes like Lonesome Moonlight Waltz or whatever, like just like little tunes, you know. But it's a little bit melted, and I played it with Bill a bunch, and I just always got a kick out of that. And it lays out really well on the banjo, and I think he told me he was trying to sort of get a banjo-type sound out of his guitar when he wrote that tune.
It works.
Anyway, I played it a bunch with Bill, and I love that tune.
It works good. Listen, I don't want to keep you all night. I've enjoyed this so much, Danny. This is such a treat for me to get to talk to you after all these years, and I'm so happy for the year you've had, and now you got this new album, which is we've been talking to death about, but we could talk for another 3 hours. I just don't want to do that to you, but it's really good. It's a neat concept that you're deliberately, you know, we talked about you want to make it more intimate, so that's why you made the decision not to use finger picks, and it's a nice, it's really fun. It's fun to listen to. You can listen to this album, and what I've done, unfortunately, I listen a lot in my car because that's when I'm alone and I can focus on music, but driving back and forth and here and there, you know, then a different one becomes my favorite, which just means this to me. It's all good album. Everything is good. There's a lot of good things to listen to. The words that you've written, the melodies, and I'm not even talking about the technique in your playing, although it's there, and we've talked about that too. There's all those components of this album that if you're, I'm a banjo geek, I love it, but if you're just a music fan, you don't have to listen to the stuff that you're doing on. It still blows my mind that you can sing and do the stuff on Get It On Down the Line, but I just don't think that's possible. But you say it happened, and I believe it. But it's a great album, man. Congratulations on a great record you put out.
Oh man, it's so nice to think that it's been well received and that you know that you appreciate it, because it's like you kind of wonder, like I wonder, man, is this getting through? And it's nice to know that you feel that way and that you're telling folks about it and playing it. That's my whole reason for being around, you know, is to try to provide things that lift people up a little bit. So that makes me really happy that you felt that way.
Well, listen, man, I found this. I signed up for it. I knew when it came out, and I think I went to your website and I ordered it right away, and you wrote your name on it, which is cool. But you have a website. People can follow you and find out what you're doing, right?
Yeah, DannyBarnes.com, of course.
Easy.
I'm on Twitter too. I put stuff on Twitter, weird things on there, and I have a good mailing list too of like where I send out like tracks and things
mailing list. And in fact, that's where I got the video from on I'm Convicted, which I posted it right away because I just
thank you.
Your wild knees or something on Twitter. I know all
that's right.
Yeah. Cool. So where do you have any plans, trips planned for next year? I mean, we've talked about where you've gone in the
past.
We're
getting the year together. My first trip is a Northwest run in January, okay. And then I'm going to be at like Rocky Grass and String Summit. And,
cool.
And I'm planning on, you know, like a Northeast run and a Southeast run probably before the summer. So I hope to get out in that neck of the woods. We're kind of getting that together now.
Well,
so. Where if people want to, they can sign up for my site, my mailing list, and then they can make like little alerts as the shows get announced. They can make alerts where they'll can get a reminder email about the event and everything like that. It's all kind of automated in that regard.
If you're doing Northeast and it's not early summer, for the last 3 years I've broadcast live from Gray Fox. They've heard the show and asked me to come up there, so I hang out. And that's a pretty cool place for.
Oh, that's a beautiful place. I've played up there a couple of times. I love that festival. Yeah. It's a great festival.
Well, if you find yourself that way in the right time of year, try to find a way to show up there. It'd be a blast.
Love it.
All right, man. Danny Barnes, thanks, brother. It's been a blast. Thanks so much for your time and
bless you.
The good discussion. I enjoyed it immensely, my friend.
Thanks a lot.
All right, I'll talk to you.
Okay, man.
Bye-bye.